I am so honored for each face that I am looking at around this room. Thank you very, very much for being here. My sister, my parents, classmates, students, colleagues, church leaders, friends. I am really, really grateful that you are here. And I am grateful for the 13 women in Atlantic Coast Conference and Lancaster Mennonite Conference who shared their stories with me. And whether they are in the room or not is not of your concern. Their stories are here, and I am grateful for them and what they shared with me. This year, I was invited to co-teach a class with Dr. Mark Wenger called Formation in God's Story. And in the fall semester, we used this book. It's called Resilient Ministry, What Pastors Told Us About Surviving and Thriving. It's actually printed in 2013, very, very recently published by Bob Burns, Tasha Chapman, and Donald Guthrie. They happen to be either pastors or seminary professors in the Midwest. These authors, they actually received a Lilly grant to study resiliency in pastors. And they interviewed 70 pastors and their spouses over about a 6 or 7 year time period. And they recorded every conversation. And then they lifted out the themes from those 70 pastors to predict what are the themes that help pastors to be resilient in ministry. And these are the six that emerged: spiritual formation, self-care, emotional intelligence, cultural intelligence, marriage and family, and leadership. In other words, these 70 pastors said, these are the six things that must be in my life in order for me to be resilient as a pastor. And I really appreciate this book. I think this book is to be commended for the depth of the interviews, the information that was gleaned. We need this book. I want to read, though, a quote. Although the cohort research was limited to the majority demographic in the pastorate of married male pastors and their wives, we believe the findings are relevant enough to help foster resilience for all those in vocational ministry. Well, that's fine that their group, maybe it's not fine, their group was in the majority demographic. 70 men were in their group. Our class of 12 students did not fall into that majority demographic. We were half and half, male and female. Some of our students work full-time in ministry. Others work part-time or work in another church-related ministry. Some were married, some were single, some had children, some did not. Some work in very unusual kinds of settings. So we did not fit, our class did not fit the majority demographic in this book. And Mark and I acknowledged at the outset of this book, make the adjustments necessary. We believe in the content of this book, but you might not find yourself in it all the time. Make the necessary adjustments. And then the kicker came one day at a break. One of the female students said to me, "Well, Anne, what is the research about how women are doing in ministry?" And I said, "I've been looking for several months to find that information, and I have not yet found it." Soon after that, we had to come up with a capstone project idea. And voila! I turned into the researcher, and I will ask the women how they are doing about being resilient in ministry. It's almost inconceivable that in the 21st century, there would be a high-level research project done, funded by the Lilly Grant, with such an important topic, and there were not women included in that study. It's also inconceivable when you think about the way that our founder of our faith regarded women. Given that women surrounded Jesus during his ministry, were the last to stay with Jesus at the cross, the first to see him resurrected, It appears clear that Jesus believed in the spiritual power and perception of women. So why does the church not hold women in the same esteem as did Jesus, the founder and center of our faith? Rauschenbach asks. Jesus partnered with women to usher in the reign of God, but not everyone who walked in his footsteps has done so. The merger of the church and state in the 4th century Europe set the tone for male hierarchy, which has been the dominant norm ever since. In our own denomination, you might remember, Emma Richards was the first woman to be ordained in 1973. That's only 42 years ago. Atlantic Coast Conference afforded credentials for women in 1987. And Lancaster Mennonite Conference in two phases, once for a license in 1999, and then it progressed to ordination in 2008. That's only 7 years ago. We're babies in this process of welcoming women into ministry, and we have miles to walk in order to catch up with Jesus. So I knew that I didn't have 6 or 7 years or a lily grant to do my interview. I didn't have 70 women to even call on. But I did set out to discover what some female pastors think about resiliency. I asked Warren Tyson, where did you go? Warren Tyson at Atlantic Coast Conference and Joanne Dietzel at Lancaster Mennonite Conference for names. I told them what I was doing and I asked them for names. Within 24 hours, I had my list. And I sent an email out to all those women who were in pastoral ministry, inviting them to participate in this project. Within a week, maybe it took 10 days, I had 13 interviews lined up. They were ready and willing to be asked. The interviews lasted between 1 hour to 2.5 hours. Some of them were in person, some were over the phone, and I typed while I listened. And this is who they were. 8 were from Lancaster Mennonite Conference, 5 from Atlantic Coast Conference. All, like I said, were in pastoral ministry settings. 4 of the women are single, 9 are married. They range in years of ministry from 3 years to 21 years. Some are part-time, some full-time. Some are in rural churches, some are in the big cities. And they all had college educations, most had masters, and a number of them have doctoral work. The stories are anonymous, so please don't even try to figure out who said what. If they want to tell you that they were in the study, that's their business, but I won't. They did not know about those 6 themes that I told you about, the resiliency themes. I didn't tell them ahead of time. I asked these open-ended questions to discern what practices they are using to be resilient. And it became very, very clear that the women were steeped in practices that resembled the findings of the book. Detailed descriptions of spiritual formation, self-care, emotional intelligence, cultural intelligence, marriage and family, that one got expanded because of singleness, as well as leadership. Lots and lots of practices. And on the front table, I have the complete list of all the things that they named that they do to be resilient. So if you want a copy of it and to learn from these women, you are welcome to take a copy. We might need to make more. It confirms in my mind even more how important it is for pastors to have a rule of life, intentional practices that tend to these 6 areas. But as much as I am delighted with the similarities between the women in this study and the men that were studied in this book, I need to be truthful that I groaned over the dissimilarities that were found between what the men said in the book and the realities of what the women are experiencing right here and right now. So I'm going to name the themes that emerged in the course of these conversations. I must say that for 7 out of the 8 women who were interviewed from Lancaster Conference, the all-male bishop board continues to be a great hurdle. I don't even know how to quite describe how much it hurts to be considered a second-class citizen and not be welcome around that table. On another note, they are grateful for every opportunity that they are afforded to be on committees, to be involved in ways of shaping the conference. So gratitude was expressed in the same way that the great sadness of being excluded was also expressed. The women also named that leadership styles can be a source of tension and challenge, that built into the style of church leadership, it has been a more of an authoritarian model. And women tend to be more collaborative, at least the women in my study are more collaborative, and they can bump up against the system, the way decision-making is happening, and even the expectations of their own congregations and the way they should be functioning. So there's a disconnect with leadership style. I have a couple pages of discrimination, and I'll just tell you a couple of stories that are difficult to hear and difficult to tell. One woman was given credentials, was ordained in another conference, and she and her husband relocated to this county, but the church that she was called to was not comfortable with the title of her receiving the pastor title. They gave her the director title, even though she was already ordained, even though she already had pastoral experience. The congregation was not able to give her the title that she deserved. Another woman, I was teaching in the STEP program, which is here through EMS Lancaster. And at the end of the course, the students are given evaluations to fill out about their teachers. And this male student said while she did a very, very good job, he could not give her the highest rating because she was a woman. Another woman was told by a male youth sponsor after she had her second child that it was time for her to step down. Another woman was asked to not serve communion to a homebound parishioner. Several have been told not to preach at funerals because it might offend a conservative relative that's there. There is a lead pastor who refused to bring the name forth for credentialing of a female. He was uncomfortable with her leadership, but the congregation was desiring it. And the final story I'll share is that one woman was meeting with the pastors in her district, and it was time for prayer, and they took turns laying hands on one another. She was last. And one of the pastors said, "Oh, we're going to have to apologize to your husband for this." And she was so offended that the sacred moment of prayer turned into this sexual harassment. There are deeply entrenched stereotypes. You know, most of our brain is unconscious, and that's where these stereotypes are. We have a lot of work to go. One person intending this to be a compliment said, "I can tell you aren't a Hillary Clinton." In other words, you're not supposed to have strong opinions, especially don't share them out loud if you do have them. The women talked about issues around their bodies. Pulpits, thankfully, this is made for a 5'2" woman, you know, but the pulpits are huge. The one woman said she got up to preach the first Sunday and only her chin and up showed above this pulpit. So you either have to get step stools or you have to change your pulpits to fit more body sizes. The portable microphones, you have to have a suit for them to work properly. You have to tuck it into your pants pocket. And you have to put this little microphone on a lapel. And women's clothing, 9 times out of 10, it doesn't work. And we make all kinds of creative adjustments just to wear a microphone. Modesty is important to the women. They're not in there. They're not up there trying to get looked. They want to be modest. But they're asking, what are the men doing to reduce the amount of sexualization of women? It's a little creepy knowing how many men, even Christian men, are viewing pornography What is the responsibility of men to curb those kinds of sexual attention and desires? And lastly, what emerged that seemed different from the women in my study in this book was a whole lot of internal messaging that they have to continually work at. Doubts, fears, worries. Am I good enough? Am I being true to who I am, or am I just copying other male counterparts? They make comparisons. How am I doing compared to my coworkers? As hard as those things were to listen to, woman after woman, story after story, what was exhilarating was a new finding. Their calling. I do not remember this being a part of the book at all. So I'm not suggesting that those 70 men weren't called. I believe they were. But it didn't seem to rise to the surface that it is a primary reason that makes them resilient. And in this study, I would suggest that this is one of the strongest things that the women have going for them that keep them resilient. The depth and breadth of their calling to ministry. When I was wrestling with this theme that was emerging, I sent an email to my coworker, Walter Sawatsky, standing back there, and I said, Walter, I really think that there's something about calling and resiliency. Remind me who writes about this. I've got to substantiate it somehow. And he reminded me of this book, The Alchemist. This is the second most read book next to A Purpose-Driven Life. So that gives it some credentials, some authenticity that people are drawn to this book about calling so deeply. So I went back and I reread part of this book, and this is what Coelho says about calling. It is God's blessing. It is the path that God chose for you here on earth. Whenever we do something that fills us with enthusiasm, we are following our legend or our compass. He goes on and he names the four defeats, the four things that get in our way from pursuing our calling. And then he says, because once we have overcome the defeats, we are filled with a greater sense of euphoria and confidence. That's what I heard from these women, that when there is a struggle to fulfill your God-given calling, you will be more resilient than in that calling. Just briefly, I want to say, how did their callings emerge in a context where it is still not normal to sense the call and pursue the call? These women had intense wrestling matches. You think Jacob wrestled with God? That was nothing compared to what these women have done over years. A number of them had an astonishing similar quote. They would say, God, if you want me to pastor, why did you put me in a woman's body? But that one just broke my heart. But over time, this loving God just continued to confirm that this was in fact what God was calling them to do. They all pointed to times in their childhood, in their youth, in their young adult years, when something happened that set that into their heart. They just had a sense that there was something that they were supposed to be doing in ministry. They had lots of external affirmations from parents and husbands, siblings, friends, pastors, leaders. It is a huge deal for you in this room and anyone else who reads this. Whatever you can do to affirm men and women in following the call, it is huge. They all started out in other careers. No one in high school, when the guidance counselor says, what do you want to be when you grow up? No one said, I want to be a pastor. None of them. Not on their radar. This developed out of being social workers or nurses or teachers or missionaries. It all happened in some other context when they liked what they were doing, but they knew there was something more. And this will make Mark and the seminarians very, very pleased. All of them that went to seminary, and they didn't all come here, mentioned that was so formative to find their voice. When they were in classes and becoming theologians and practitioners and surrounded by others who were also developing their call, it was enormously influential to their own acceptance of their call. So where do we go from here? I call upon the Confession of Faith in a Mennonite Perspective. Article 15 reads, "The Church calls, trains, and appoints gifted men and women to a variety of leadership ministries on its behalf. These may include such offices as pastor, deacon, and elder, as well as evangelists, missionaries, teachers, conference ministers, and overseers." So how can we monitor the extent to which Lancaster Mennonite Conference and Atlantic Coast Conference are carrying out this core denominational belief? Well, there's lots of good news. There are women on both credentialing bodies for ACC and LMC, so women are at the table when credentials are being afforded. There are different kinds of structures, but there's an executive committee-ish for both conferences, and women are involved on both of those groups. But as mentioned earlier, in Lancaster Conference, the bishop board would be all male. And the reality for Atlantic Coast Conference is there are two female overseers, conference ministers, in New York City, which is a wonderful blessing, but there are none locally. So when you think about the people who are doing the supervising of pastors locally, there are no women in that role. And that's, I think, very significant. The women did express, I think virtually all of them expressed their appreciation directly for Keith and for Warren, for the ways that you do respect and involve women to the extent that you can. But certainly the invitation is to continue to expand women being involved at all levels. I think one of my greatest struggles, and I'm going to read this question slowly, is how do we work at this when women are not fully present at the center of decision making and power sharing? When I was on the board at Bridge of Hope Bucksmont, as soon as we possibly could, we got a graduate of our program onto our board so that we would stop talking about those homeless women and children and begin talking with a graduate of the program. So I find it very difficult to imagine how we can make serious progress unless women are at the table at all levels. A second way forward is developing a sense of cultural humility. If you were here for Tracy Brown or for Nathan's, I think this is essentially what they're talking about as well. Cultural humility grew out of the Rodney King police beatings and riots. The people in the medical field were realizing the gaps that there were between races and cultures and economics, and there was just so much mistrust, and it was interfering with their ability to do the medical work. And two African-American women, I forget which hospital in LA, developed this cultural humility. And it didn't take long for the social workers to jump on board, and it spread to other fields. And I think it is a very Jesus-centered way of thinking and acting. And let me read this quote. "Given the complexity of multiculturalism, it is beneficial to understand cultural competency as a process rather than an end product. From this perspective, competency involves more than gaining factual knowledge. It also includes our ongoing attitudes toward both our clients and ourselves. The basic understanding is that people choose humility over certainty." So So we are in a culture of humility invites us to be constantly open to the experience of the other while paying attention to what's going on inside ourselves as we're relating to somebody who is different than us. It's a posture of curiosity. It's a posture of being open to God in another person. Three factors that I think could be extremely helpful for us as we continue to make progress in male-female relationships and ministry. Critical self-reflection. How am I doing? Mitigating power imbalances. How are you doing? And developing institutional accountability. How are we doing? I believe these three questions could be very, very helpful to us. And I believe that it's a lifelong process. It's not just about the next goal to reach, like a woman on the bishop board. That's a goal, something to work toward. But it's culture humility is saying it's the process of relationships and understanding one another that will get a more complete transformation. A third suggestion is transformational leadership, a change in the style and the way we lead. Transformational leadership seeks in part to draw out the best in others. They accomplish this goal by seeking collaboration and motivating others to follow in ways that are personally and professionally beneficial. Women have generally been associated with this type of leadership. Men generally engage in behaviors that could best be described as transactional leadership, patterns of behavior involving series of exchanges based on rewards and punishments. And the studies are supporting this. In our 21st century postmodern world, we're moving toward transformational leadership. It's really not about the transaction of from top to bottom and who does what. Society is leading the way. What if the church could actually lead the way in this process? When you think about Jesus, was he transactional? Was he a top-down guy? I don't think so. Jesus himself was a transformational leader, bringing about the best in the people around him, setting them free to do the work and to build the kingdom of God. And lastly, the women made the suggestion to seminaries, this is all seminaries, hire female faculty and administrators. Address work-life expectations. Address female-male dynamics and boundaries. Include female authors in your courses. And use inclusive language. In closing, I want to tell two stories. One is a personal story, and one is a story of hope. So in 1995, I chaired a search committee to find a youth pastor for the church that we were attending at the time. It was a great installation service, and after it was over, my husband Todd and I hosted a meal for Ben and his wife and for the church leader that he invited to give the sermon at his installation service. And his family. And during the course of lunch, somehow I confessed that I was quieting the call to go to seminary, in part because the first pastoring experience that I had ended in burnout, and I didn't know if I could handle a church environment again. And the second reason was it was the mid-90s, and I'm watching what women are going through to be called into ministry, and it didn't look pretty, and I didn't think that I wanted to spend my time that way. There surely could be other things that I could do, and I did do lots of other really exciting things between 1995. And here I stand 20 years later, in seminary, of all things. But when I admitted that at the table, Basil looked at me and he said, "Anne, do you know what's so unusual about the burning bush that Moses saw?" And I didn't have an answer. And he said, it's that it didn't burn out. If this call is from God, it will not burn out, and you will have to do something with it. So it took 20 years. But and it's not that I didn't do ministry in the last 20. I just didn't do this kind of ministry that I'm talking about today. So I am grateful for Basil's, for his metaphor that kept me paying attention to that burning sense within me that there was something more yet for me to do. And the final story is from this past Sunday at James Street Mennonite Church. We were having a wonderful church service. Where's Stan again? There he is.
Can I leave the room?
No, it was brilliant. He had a wonderful sermon. We had fabulous singing, worship. It was just a great day. Then it's time for communion. And Stan, he just says, "Oh, I forgot to line up servers for the balcony. Do I have two volunteers?" Well, I'm so steeped right now in inclusion, exclusion kinds of topics. My arm just went right up without thinking. Of course, no one's going to get excluded. And I raised my hand, and me and another, Wendy, we volunteered, and Stan gave us our tray, and we went up to the balcony. We served communion, went back down, got our tray of the cup of juice. We went upstairs, and there was a little girl waiting for us. And I perceived that she wanted to help, that something was happening to her. She was mesmerized by this communion thing. She had a call. And I don't even know her name. I know whose daughter she is, but I don't know her name. And I called her over. I said, "Do you want to help?" "Yes." I didn't take it to our oversight board. I didn't go down and ask Stan. I just did it. I thought, if this girl wants to serve communion, certainly Jesus said a few things about welcoming the children. So I coached her. This is what you do. I just kind of stood behind her, and she did a marvelous job of sending this juice down the row. And then I asked her, "Do you want to go down and give this to Stan?" "Yes." So we marched down, and she handed it to Stan, and he graciously received it. And then it was time for her to go back up to the balcony, and she starts heading the wrong direction. And she kind of, like, at one point, she looks to me, and I said, "No." And she found her steps, and she went back to her mom. I thought, what if this was the way that calling occurred in our churches? What if we paid attention to the little girls and the little boys who have this urge to serve Jesus, and we say, "Yes, that's sacred, that's good. Let me help you do that. Let me coach you into this calling and pay attention to it with you." So that is my prayer, is that in 20 years from now, she'll be standing up here, and she'll be giving a completely different capstone project, because this will be behind us. We will have learned how to love and respect and call each other out to serve Jesus. Thank you.